You are listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak. Democrats took back the House, Republicans kept the Senate, and President Trump got rid of his attorney general. More shakeups could be on the way this week. Joining us today is the political junkie Ken Rudin. Welcome to Insight as usual, Ken.
Randall, thank you so much. It's almost a sad thing that we have to talk about politics and given what's going on in California. So, well, obviously, my heart is out to everybody who's suffering and losing, and it's just awful.
You wouldn't expect politics to get into the mix when it comes to a wildfire this early in the grieving process. But we just spoke with Cal Fire regarding the deadly campfire, and over the weekend, President Donald Trump tweeted, and this is a direct quote, "There is no reason for these massive, deadly, and costly forest fires in California except that forest management is so poor. Billions of dollars are given each year with so many lives lost, all because of gross mismanagement of the forests. Remedy now or no more Fed payments." So blowback on this tweet was quick and fierce from Governor Jerry Brown and California Firefighters Union, members of Congress. What's your take, Ken?
Well, everybody should have an immediate blowback on it. The fact that the empathizer in chief was supposed, I mean, look, the president of the United States, you know, we've seen it after Oklahoma City. We saw it after 9/11. We saw it after gun violence around the country. The president is always the kind of person who needs to calm down the country and soothe the country and say that, you know, the federal government will do whatever's possible. And we mourn for the victims and we suffer along with you. And to make this a political tweet, and exactly, you know, Randall, as you said this, I was listening, remedy now or no more Fed payments. I mean, it's more bullying and bluster at a time when soothing is desperately needed, especially in California.
And we have some tape of Congressman Adam Schiff on Meet the Press with Chuck Todd responding to the wildfires and President Trump's comments. Let's take a listen to that.
There are a lot of root causes about why the fire season has become so much worse over the years. But, you know, for the president at a time when people are facing utter disaster, to be making a statement like this, making a threat like this, this just goes to show how little he understands the job he has. That he would be punitive at a time like this rather than coming to the defense of people facing the worst disaster of their lives. He's out there making these broad and false statements and threatening to remove funding from a state that's devastated right now.
Do you think it's a political thing because California's so blue?
I do. This is a president who, more than any other, is punitive. And I think we saw that in the tax cut by taking away state and local tax deductions. That was aimed at the blue states. Basically, he is only the president, I think, in his view, of those who voted for him. The rest he could care less.
So what's your take on those comments, Ken?
Well, look, Adam Schiff, of course, is the next chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. He is a partisan Democrat, but I think I agree with everything he's saying. Look, I can't get into Donald Trump's head and say that he is doing this because he still resents the fact that California, with its 4 million votes for Hillary Clinton, you know, gave her the popular vote lead in 2016. But, you know, I mean, he seems to be at war with the state. He's been at war with Jerry Brown on issues like immigration and climate change and things like that. And perhaps that's part of it. But I still think it's more of a lack of empathy that we've just seen over and over again. We saw it with the devastation of Puerto Rico during those terrible storms and hurricanes where just, you know, power was out for months and everything was just devastated. And it was just about, there's just no sense. You know, I remember years ago when George H.W. Bush was campaigning for re-election in 1992, and he was in a supermarket and he didn't know how the scanner worked, or he didn't know the price of a gallon of milk. And everybody said, oh, my God, how can we have a president who doesn't know this? And we've seen instance after instance after instance where this president will just, you know, just say things that just seem to be so tone deaf when it comes to emotion and heartstrings and basic decency. So I know I'm pretty harsh on this one, but how do you talk about cutting back money and punitive measures when there is so much suffering? It just makes no sense to me.
Ken, a year ago, October, when the fires happened in Santa Rosa and several counties throughout Northern California, there was a swath of giant fires that hit all at the same time, mostly wind-driven. The president at that time, it was the most destructive in California's history. The president did not come and visit those scenes. Is that, again, based on California's blue status?
Well, California's blue status, or the, like I said, California is the one that robbed him of his popular vote victory. He does seem to have it in for California, and at the same time, California has made it clear that Governor Brown and the state itself will be the launching point for the not Trump, you know, the revolution against Trump on those issues we talked about. So it seems like it's punitive. It seems like it's directed to California. But again, also, I just think it's part of it, part of the president's makeup. And again, I'm not a psychiatrist. I only play one on the radio, but it just seems like it's just wrongheaded. And there's no reason why he couldn't go on and say, This is a terrible tragedy. We'll worry about politics later. Let's just get all the aid and help and support we can to what's going on in California. But we don't hear that.
And Ken, California appears to be shifting from blue to deeper blue. Vote counting continues for some really tight congressional races following last week's election, including several here in California. In the Modesto area, Democrat Josh Harder took the lead over incumbent Republican Jeff Denham. That happened Friday evening. Ken, it appears the late votes are trending Democratic.
You know, it's funny. I was talking with Beth on Tuesday night on the air, and matter of fact, on Wednesday morning as well. I said, well, you know, Democrats did very well in the House and the Republicans did very well in the Senate, and it's kind of a mixed message. But in the days since the election, it seems like more and more counting is going on. And as the more and more counts and votes come in, the Democrats seem to be benefiting. You know, once upon a time, we were talking about all those seats that Hillary Clinton, California, that Hillary Clinton carried in 2016. And they said, well, maybe this might be ripe for the picking for the Democrats. And then on Tuesday night, it didn't look like it happened. But as we say, it is growing. I mean, the Democrats won the seat Daryl Issa gave up. They beat Dana Rohrabacher. He's been there since 1988, 30 years in the Senate. They beat Steve Knight, that's been a Republican seat since 1992. And as you say, Jeff Denham is now trailing in the 10th district by 3,300 votes. That's the district east of San Jose. And the Democrats could pick up that as well. Now, the other seats they wanted, it's in the seat in the 39th district where Ed Royce is retiring. The Republicans still have a slight lead on that. Further south, Mimi Walters, an Orange County Republican, still has a 2,000-vote lead.
But that
the Democrats really wanted that, too.
And as the votes have come in, that lead has shrunk, has it not?
Well, as 2,000 is the last I heard, if it's okay. Even shorter than lower than that, then that's interesting. And then, of course, the Duncan Hunter win in San Diego. And while nobody ever thought that the Democrats had a shot there, the fact that, you know, you're reelecting a member of Congress who's under indictment is not a good sign. But I suspect if Duncan Hunter is going to be beaten, he'll be beaten in an upcoming Republican primary. But again, the Democrats had a good day. You know, I mean, Dianne Feinstein's Senate race, which was never in doubt, was maybe closer than some people thought. But she won comfortably against a fellow Democrat, of course. You know, Gavin Newsom won the governorship pretty easily, as expected. And they picked up their seats. But the fact is, what we seem to be forgetting is that it looks like the Democratic gain in the House, which is right now at 32, it could grow to 35, 36, is the biggest Democratic gain since 1974, the Watergate midterm election, where the Democrats, you know, went wild in the aftermath of the Watergate break-in and all the scandals that were going on. So this is not just a good year for the Democrats. It's a great year, given the fact that we have to go back to 1974 for the last time the Democrats did this well in the House.
And Ken, I didn't mean to throw you off there. What I meant to say was that the 2,000-plus votes that Walters has the lead right now, that's down from before, that it's been shrinking.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And on election night, Jeff Denham was winning. So he's now down. Mimi Walters' margin is much further down. And the Republican margin in the Ed Royce seat is is also much narrower than it was on election night, even if the Republicans do keep those seats.
And California, of course, does not have a lock on tight races. A recount, another recount, we should say, in Florida. The president is tweeting this morning that the Florida election should be called in favor of the Republicans.
Oh, really? Oh, really? Is that what he said? You know something? I never knew that. So they have recounts in Florida? I never knew they had those in Florida.
Yeah, no chads. No hanging chads this time. It's a different
no
process.
Hanging chads. Well, they may want to hang the Broward County head of elections there. But my goodness, that the Senate race and the governor race is so close. In the Senate race, Rick Scott has a 12,000 vote lead over Senator Bill Nelson, which is 0.15% of a difference. In the governor's race, it's also very, very close. Ron DeSantis is lead over, or Andrew Gillum is 0.41%. The Republicans are calling foul. They're saying that the Democrats are coming up with new votes that are coming out of nowhere, and they're yelling fraud, and there's obviously no evidence of that, but that hasn't stopped the president and other Republicans for charging that. And then we're talking about races that are not resolved yet. Also, the Arizona Senate race, where Kirsten Sinema has a 32,000 vote lead over Martha McSally. This is the seat that Jeff Flake is giving up. So for all the gains that the Republicans had in the Senate, in Missouri, and possibly Florida, definitely North Dakota and Indiana, the Democrats picked up, with Jackie Rosen over Dean Heller in Nevada, and if they win in Arizona, it'll only be a two-seat pickup for the Republicans. And given the fact that 26 of the 35 seats that were up, I bet you didn't know that math was an important factor in this whole thing, but 26 of the 35 seats were Democratic seats. I think the Democrats did okay for themselves in limiting their net losses to just two.
And in Arizona, it is the Democrat that is slightly ahead right now.
Right. Kirsten Sinema, 32,000 vote lead, right. And also in Georgia, the key is not that whether Brian Kemp will have a larger lead, a bigger lead over Stacey Abrams. But in Georgia, you have to get, if you don't get 50% of the vote, you go into a runoff. And right now, Brian Kemp, margin, he has 50.28%. So if the votes coming in will get him under 50%, there'll be a do-over in a couple of weeks, maybe early next month. But even though the Democrat, Stacey Abrams, is trailing right now.
All right. You're listening to Insight. We're speaking with political junkie Ken Rudin. And Ken, I didn't tell you about this tweet, and you don't necessarily have to have a response, but the president just tweeted recently this morning that the stock market is down. And President Trump saying in a tweet, the prospect of presidential harassment by the Dems is causing the stock market big headaches.
Oh.
I guess that says it all right there. Okay. Growing controversy.
I don't know whether to laugh or cry, and I think I just did both. But the fact is that the Democrats have basically had no say, no check on the president in the first 2 years of the Trump's term. And now that they have control of the House, they are talking about investigations and subpoenas. Gerald Nadler, who's going to take over the Judiciary Committee, he said the first person he wants to appear before the Judiciary Committee in January is Matt Whitaker, the new acting attorney general in the aftermath of Jeff Sessions' firing.
Right.
And he said if he won't appear willingly, we'll subpoena him. But basically, the Democrats have a shot or a chance at preserving something that Robert Mueller is doing with the investigation into the Trump campaign activities, because for the longest time, we felt that by getting rid of James Comey, by getting rid of Jeff Sessions, and now putting in a loyalist like Matt Whitaker, the next thing on the chopping block would be Robert Mueller. So Democrats in the House, with the power they have, are going to do whatever they can to make sure that doesn't happen.
Ken, any chance Whitaker may recuse himself the way Sessions did because Whitaker has been critical of the Mueller investigation?
I can't see it. I think he's already said no, and I think Trump has already said, well, everybody has an opinion, so I can't. So, everybody has an opinion. I can't have everybody recusing themselves. But the fact is, the guy he picks for attorney general has gone on record saying that I don't think much of the federal judiciary, and I don't think much about the Mueller investigation, and it's a witch hunt, and now he's the attorney general of the United States. I don't know if he would recuse himself, but there's no question how he feels about the investigation. But there are other things, too. There are other ethics questions and business deals that he's been a part of that it sounds like the White House didn't even vet, you know, in picking Whitaker. Notice they didn't pick Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general. One might think that that would be the logical person to pick. But, of course, they're not going to do that, given how Rosenstein feels about the Mueller investigation and how Whitaker feels about it. But once again, it looks like a possibly bungled decision to appoint Whitaker, and we'll just see how much stink the Democrats make of it.
Kellyanne Conway's husband, who, you know, often disagrees with the viewpoints of his wife, has written an article saying, or a commentary saying, that it's unconstitutional.
It was blistering. I mean, that op-ed was, he said it was unconstitutional. And I mean, he just said everything that Whitaker does or says regarding the Mueller investigation is just unlawful. And I know that, you know, yes, he's not on the same page as his wife when it comes to Donald Trump. And we've always known this. But this was something else. I mean, this was really a no holds barred assault on the choice of Whitaker. And well, you know, I mean, I could never explain James Carville and Mary Madeline, that marriage, but this one may be also interesting to, and they're both Republican, but not both Trump Republicans.
Opposites attract. So yeah. President Trump, finally, Ken, President Trump was in Europe this weekend to mark the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. Now, while there, French President Emmanuel Macron had some strong words regarding nationalism. Help put this into context for us.
Well, I mean, this is something. I mean, first of all, during the campaign, the 28 campaign, Donald Trump was decided that globalism and globalists were the enemy of the American people, along with the press, of course. And he said he was a nationalist. Now, you know, that, you know, I mean, nationalism has different ways of seeing it. But of course, a lot of people are saying, well, does that mean white nationalism? And of course, that may be unfair to the president. But a lot of people are saying that nationalist is too strong of a word. And so for Macron to say in Paris for the 100th anniversary of the ending of World War I, I mean, a very solemn occasion. And he gives a very serious speech saying that, look, I am a patriot, but I am not a nationalist. And he says this as these nationalist regimes are, like, for example, in Poland and Hungary, maybe even Italy, where either white nationalists or right-wing groups are taking over the government, running the government, punishing the press. And Macron says this is exactly the kind of divisiveness that we tried to end once and for all in 1918. And a lot of the divisions are showing again. So Macron was a very tough statement on Trump, given the fact that he wanted to be his BFF, you know, last time they met. But right now, relationships between Trump and our normal Western allies, Britain, France, Germany, are really hurting. And notice that, you know, Trump's best friend in Paris during the celebration was a guy by the name of Vladimir Putin.
Do you think world leaders are feeling more freedom to be critical of President Trump in the current climate?
Well, the ones I mentioned, yes, but other ones, no. I mean, other ones basically agree with Trump that globalism is hurting the world, that immigration. I mean, there are a lot of countries in Western Europe or Eastern Europe as well who feel that they're either overrun with immigration or just, you know, it's just, you know, sapping the country, their country's moral fiber. So a lot of the rhetoric about immigration and immigrants and people of color, we're hearing coming from more and more governments that are becoming autocratic. But for countries like Germany, France, England, which have immigration problems, they are very worried by the tone and the kind of rhetoric we're hearing not only out of Washington, but from some of these movements in Europe as well.
All right, that's political junkie Ken Rudin. An interesting week we've just had. We'll see what follows, right? Thanks for
being. Well, you know, every time I'm on with Beth, I say, oh, we'll never see a week like this. And next week, I say, oh, my God, do you see what happened this week?
That's why you're a recurring guest.
Or a recurring headache, right.
Because there's always topics of interest. Ken Rudin, thank you so much for being on Inside, as always.
Thank you, Randall.
And of course, we have more on our website. You can find it at capradio.org/insight. And if you haven't noticed, because I've said insight twice already, you are listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio.